Tim Cohen attended the Air Force Academy, class of 1988, and while there became a Christian in November of 1986. And then not too long after that, having read through the New Testament two or three times, and part of the Old Testament, a good portion of it, I asked God to show me who and what was being spoken of in Revelation 13 because of the really strange imagery there about a beast with feet like a bear, body like a leopard, mouth like a lion, you know, the red dragon, etc. And at that point, of course, I believed enough to where I was convinced, okay, it's all true, but how does this make sense? And so I asked God, and within a month of that, I had actually in my hands the official coat of arms heraldic achievement that matches that imagery, as well as the English name calculation and other things. So basically within a month of that, God showed me that it not only existed, but it existed now, is literal more so than the church has historically anticipated it would be. And then, of course, I began as well, based on other things that I read in Scripture, to work on what I'm still working on, one of the things, which is the Messiah history and the Tribulation Period multi-volume series. So in 1998, I put out the first edition of a book called The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, which gives hard evidence on the actual identity of the foretold Antichrist. So I'm not speculating. In other words, I'm basing it around hard evidence that's biblically testable, things that exist now.
Well, yeah, but you mm-hmm. talked to him about God showed me this, God showed me that. Well, hang on, because you know, this surely could just be, you know, your prejudices involved here. You're looking for something, you're finding it. It's not necessarily God even involved. Research doesn't always involve God, does it? It may be you've just turned something up that you wanted to find.
Well, but I wasn't looking for it. That's the thing. You know, I prayed and I asked God to show me. And then I went to, in this case, a weekend Bible study, really a lunch after a Sabbath service at a local pastor's home in Colorado Springs. This was a guy who worked for Martin Marietta at the time, and he and some other engineers there had, and this was totally unknown to me, by the way, when he was explaining this to me, had done a program, I guess in their spare time, to try to figure out how to do a name calculation to calculate the number of the beast, the number of this person who would be the Antichrist, described in Revelation 13. And so they did this computer program, and they put a database against it of world leaders and royalty around the world. And
so, you know, so this is trying to work out the number of 666.
And somebody else was doing that, yeah.
Keying into that code.
Guy named Monty Judah. This is the person to whom I'm referring. But anyway, he was the engineer at the time. Anyway, they came up with one name out of all the global leaders, all the royalty in the world and so forth in this program of theirs that spit out as 666. And based on that, he went down to the libraries in Colorado Springs. This was, again, before I met him, actually, shortly before I met him. And he found on the front cover of one of the books on heraldry in a library there in the Springs, an unofficial version, not the official one, of this person whose name spit out as 666. And on that unofficial version, it looked like it had the imagery described in Revelation 13. Now, he showed me that stuff. And this was within a month of me praying there at the academy. And I wasn't looking for any of it. So I went back that day. This was a Saturday afternoon now, after that lunch, to the cadet library at the academy. And I thought, no, this is really interesting. And so I started to look through what they had was about a half a bookshelf or so of books on heraldry there in the library. And I started to thumb through them purely out of curiosity. And I found the one book in the world at that time. There was only one book on the planet that actually had the official coat of arms, the imagery in it. And that was a book called Boutell's Heraldry. And I documented that in the first edition of The Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. And the coat of arms that's on the front cover of The Antichrist and the Cup of Tea came out of that book originally. But this coat of arms was first shown to the world in 1969 at the investiture of Prince Charles as Prince of Wales at Caernarvon Castle. And it was only up to the point of being in Boutel's heraldry on memorabilia from the investor, like the order of service, saucers and cups sold at the investor, that kind of thing. And then in this book, Boutel's Heraldry, which the cadet library happened to have, you know, out of all the books in heraldry in the world on heraldry, the cadet library happened to have the one that I needed to see. So this was the same day that this engineer showed me these things. And this is why I say God showed me. It's not that I was looking for it. It's more like he led me by the nose.
Well, Prince Charles is an interesting character, isn't he? What is it that ties him then, in a nutshell, to the crest of his heraldry, or whatever you call it, to what it says in the Bible?
Well, there are multiple things. So, and I'll just go down the line of some of the evidence. One, of course, is the imagery, which is a creature with feet like a bear, body like a leopard, mouth like a lion. And Revelation 13, describing this imagery, says it rises out of the sea. In context, that would be off the coast, if you will, of Israel, or somewhere out of the sea relative to Israel's coast. And that this red dragon, that's a red dragon of Revelation 12, which is identified also as a symbol of Satan, gives this beast that has the feet like a bear, body like a leopard, mouth like a lion, his power, throne, and great authority. So that's the imagery in Revelation 13, which in the same chapter goes on to tell us that this beast has a number. It's the number of the name of a man, quote unquote, that calculates to 666. That's what we get from Revelation 13, apart from it telling us that this person someday will have authority over the world's nations for a period of 3.5 years. Daniel chapter 7 in the Old Testament describes the same individual who will also have authority for the same 3.5 year period over the nations of the world, but with completely different imagery. In Daniel chapter 7, he's called the little horn of the eyes of a man. And in the context of Daniel historically, and when he was, you know, penning the book of Daniel, that would have been a unicorn with human eyes. So there's the imagery. Besides all that, there's the name calculation, and a lot of people historically have tried to contrive systems to do the calculation, invent systems, have tampered with names, in other words, altered the normal rendering or spelling of names.
You've got a major problem here, Tim, and that is that there's all sorts of different ways of coding names and letters into numbers.
But there's not, and this is where I'm going. You know, you would think that reading the English translation, for example, or for that matter, any translation of the book of Revelation, where you read the number 666 and it says calculate the name. If that's the only information we had, then you could easily argue, well, hey, what system are you supposed to use? Let's go create a system and see what we come up with. The problem is that all those translations come from the underlying Greek text. So the original text is in Greek. And in the Greek text of Revelation 13:18, it actually identifies the system for the calculation. Not a lot of people realize this. Most numbers throughout the Bible, and we're talking both Old Testament and Hebrew, as well as New Testament and Greek, are written in the form of words. You know, like we would write SIX for the number 6 in English. There are a few exceptions. And in the New Testament, there are really only a couple of exceptions, both in the book of Revelation. One is the number 144 for the 144,000 that we read about, for example, in Revelation 14, the 144,000 sealed Israelites. The other exception is the number 666 in Revelation 13, verse 18. In the Greek text, those numbers are not written with words. Instead, they're specified with specific Greek letters that have numbers assigned to them. So 666 in the case of Revelation 13, 18 is written with one Greek letter for the number 600, a second letter for the number 60, and a third letter for the number 6. And because it's given that way, rather than written in the form of words, it actually identifies the system we're supposed to use for the calculation. So it's not open to interpretation. And as it turns out, that system is derived from the ancient Hebrew numbering system. In ancient Hebrew, the original system, you know, Hebrew has 22 glyphs, hieroglyphs is what they really are. We typically call them characters, but they're glyphs. And each of those glyphs has a number assigned, and it goes 1 through 9, then 10 through 90, so 10, 20 up through 90, and then 100 through 400, 100, 200, 300, 400, and it stops. It gets cut off at that point in the Hebrew because there are only 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. But the system was transferred sequentially, not phonetically, but sequentially, historically, to the ancient Greek language. And in the Greek version, after that transfer was accomplished, it was expanded to include 500 through 900 because Greek has more than 22 characters in its alphabet. So it was able to accommodate the rest of the system, if you will. And it's the Greek version that's used to specify 666 in Revelation. On that system, because it is sequential and not phonetic, we therefore, and there's a precedent for that, in other words, historically, we can take that same system and we can apply it to any language on earth.
So what's that Greek system called, Tim?
Well, it's called the Kabbalic numbering system today in Hebrew, even though it's not really Kabbalic. They call it that because it's typically used in Kabbalism, which is Jewish mysticism. But in reality, it predates Kabbalism, and it's the ancient biblical numbering system. There's no name for it. It's the biblical numbering system in Hebrew. And it was transferred historically, sequentially, to Greek. And I don't even know that there is a separate name for it either in Greek, but that's the system that's used in Revelation 13:18. And we can transfer it sequentially to any language there is, including English.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, anyone listening, is there anywhere we can easily look up where you've shown that this system, first of all, it is the biblical Greek system that was originally used in Revelation, which was written, I think, on the island of Patmos. And also that the calculation works out with Prince Charles's name, because people might wish to try other names in that system too.
Sure, anybody can Google this and look up. They can look up the Antichrist Nicopatee.
Not necessarily Google.
Well, the name calculation. What I'm telling you, the name calculation that is in the Antichrist Nicopatee, where I actually show the system has been put online by others, and there are sample chapters also of the Antichrist Nicopatee, the first edition online, where people can see the name calculation with the Hebrew, the English, and the Greek. And I've got more information on that, quite a bit more, by the way, in the second edition that's coming out. But what we've been discussing is available online. And in addition to that, they can go and look up an interlinear Greek-English New Testament, in this case, the Book of Revelation online. There are several examples online. They can look up Revelation chapter 13 in an interlinear Greek-English translation, and they can find the number 666 in the English translation in that interlinear version online and see that the number is specified with three Greek letters. It's not written in the form of words.
So, I mean, we've got the number of a man. We've also got the symbolism in the crest of Prince Charles. Anything else in there that ties him to what it actually says in Revelation that you were originally talking about?
So there are multiple other things. One is the lineage. You know, one of the requirements to be the Messiah, or for this matter, a counterfeit Messiah for Israel, and I'm speaking of Israel that does not believe that Jesus is the Messiah, you know, or the God of Israel incarnate that rejects Yeshua as the Messiah. They're looking for a person to come along who can show a credible lineage with descent from Israel's ancient King David. Now, Israel's ancient genealogical records were destroyed when the Romans, you know, sacked Jerusalem in 70 AD, roughly, and then later, early in the second century, with the Bar Kokhba revolution, you know, leveled what was left. The genealogical records of the nation of Israel were destroyed and lost with that. So, for anybody to come along today and attempt to show a lineage to King David is challenging, to say the least. But as it turns out, the British monarchy has a fairly granular genealogical record. Queen Elizabeth II's official lineage, in fact, was published decades ago. And I offer it as a chart through Prophecy House, the actual official lineage chart of Prince Charles' mother. And on that chart, they make explicit claim to descent from King David. The British monarchy makes explicit claim to sit upon the throne of David. they make explicit claim to be the royal house of Israel and the royal lineage of King David. And for whatever reason, that genealogical set of claims has been taken seriously enough in Israel to have been announced multiple times on national television that Prince Charles is a descendant of King David. And so far as I know, that announcement has not been made for any other human being on the planet.
Well, so he's also said, interestingly, Tim, he's also said he's a descendant of Count Dracula.
So, well, he is. He actually is.
The big question there is, when did these claims begin? Because, of course, we know there was a very powerful Zionist movement in Britain under Queen Victoria. And it could be that those claims to be from the line of David originated as recently as then.
That's very possible. In fact, I'll be honest with you, I don't accept the claims. My point is only that Israel does. Somebody in Israel, in the rabbinic community, accepts those claims enough to have permitted such an announcement on national television more than once in Israel. I mean, that is stunning. Even if it's all made up, that's stunning. Now, the other thing is, the same lineage chart shows descent from what could be the Danites. And that very likely is a legitimate claim. And when I say the Danites, I'm talking about ancient Israel's tribe of Dan. And one reason that would be significant is that there's a prophecy concerning the tribe of Dan in Genesis. I think it's around 49 or 50, chapter 49 or 50, I forget. But a prophecy in which the red dragon, a serpent, a word in Hebrew that can be translated as red dragon, is associated with the tribe of Dan, and also with causing its rider, who is named Yeshua in the Hebrew text, to fall backward. It's a messianic prophecy. In other words, this idea that a serpent, by the way, or a red dragon would strike the heels of a horse whose rider is named Yeshua so that the rider falls backward. That's a prophecy about the tribe of Dan. And ancient Israel sages looked at that prophecy and they concluded from it, and the early church concluded from it, that the Antichrist, the counterfeit Messiah, would descend from the tribe of Dan. And what's also interesting about that is it was the tribe of Dan that led ancient Israel into idolatry, resulting in the civil war that led to the schism between Judea and Israel, what became basically two nations. And then ultimately, Israel going into Assyrian captivity and later Judea into Babylonian captivity. And because of all of that, the tribe of Dan ended up being excluded, omitted completely from the 144,000 sealed Israelites in the book of Revelation, who are to be testifying, if you will, a kind of witness, but testifying concerning Yeshua, concerning Jesus to the nation of Israel during that 3.5 year period when the Antichrist will have sway over the nations of the world. So,
okay, so look, all that is to say, through these various lineage proofs. Is there. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of the number of a man, the heraldry, the lineage, anything else?
Oh, yes. Like I said, there are several things. One of the most interesting things to me, and there are others, but one of the most interesting is the statue. You know, the first edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea was published in 1998. So it didn't have the statue that I'm about to talk about. But in the early 2000s, a statue was created to Prince Charles, and this was after the Rio Earth Summit. It was a statue commissioned by a Brazilian state government in Tocantins, which is on the outskirts of a Brazilian rainforest, to Prince Charles, an angelic figure. They actually called it in the press a winged god, quote unquote, but an angelic figure with Prince Charles' face, standing atop a mass of human bodies, one of which is drinking a bottle of wine, dressed only in a loincloth, nothing else, and having his head. This is a bronze statue. They created it in two versions, the artist did. One was a miniature version, which was actually presented to Prince Charles in person and photographed by the BBC. And they did both a news report on it, where there's an audio report. You can probably still pull it up on the internet, as well as, you know, photographs, and talked about it and mentioned that the full size version, which nobody's ever seen, it's crated away somewhere in a warehouse, presumably. But the full size version was to be about 15 feet roughly. in height. And, you know, four and a half meters, pardon me. So about 15 and a half feet. But anyway, one of the interesting things about the Antichrist is that an idol is to be erected to him. And scripture calls it, both in the Gospels and the New Testament and the Olivet Discourses, where Jesus himself was speaking of future events. He called it the abomination that causes desolation. And it's a quote, actually, from Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, where it's translated typically as abomination that causes desolation. It's also translatable as the desolating abomination, but it is an idol that is to be erected in a newly constructed holy place, it appears, which doesn't exist right now. A newly constructed holy place on the Temple Mount in Israel in the future. So in other words, there's a statue that's to be erected at some point in the future, presumably in a holy of holies of a coming temple in Israel.
What about, doesn't the Bible talk about this abomination of desolation being animated in some way?
Yes. Not so much animated as speaking. So we could think of that as voice synthesis today, potentially, but speaking. So it'll have, in some sense, a voice. And to put this in a little bit more context, Revelation 13, the same chapter that has the imagery and the name calculation, also speaks of a coming mark that is to be implemented to the Antichrist, so that people around the world will not be able to buy or sell unless they have that mark in some fashion imprinted on or embedded in their hand or forehead.
Okay, this is the mark of the beast.
Yes, and it's typically the right hand or the forehead, the way that it's written in, the way it's described in Scripture. Now, a lot of people today, Christians particularly, have engaged in some pretty, I will say, outlandish speculations on the nature of the mark. A lot of people say it's a biochip implant, and it could be, and I'll come back to why I say it's outlandish in a moment. You know, that it could be any number of things that people talk about. What they're not doing is looking carefully at the Greek text, and that's so important here to understand what it's talking about when it talks about a mark. In this case, the Greek word that's translated as mark is actually talking about a tattoo that has a picket-like fence appearance. So there's a very specific meaning to that Greek word. And it is a tattoo with a particular kind of an appearance. Why that's interesting is that the UPC and EAN barcodes that we already can't buy or sell without around the world look like a picket fence kind of pattern. And every one of those barcodes, UPC and EAN specifically, has a guard bar pattern. It's called the guard bar pattern. It's also called, alternately, the security bar pattern. And those are the two bars on either end of the code and then in the middle of the code, two bar patterns and then the bar pattern in the middle, which descend halfway roughly below the numbers that they're showing you, the digits that they are showing on these barcodes. So in other words, there's a set of bars on either end and then another set in the middle of each of these barcodes where they're not showing you the numbers that those bars represent. And those numbers are 666 in all cases. So in other words, the security bar pattern or the guard bar pattern of those barcodes is 666 in all cases throughout the world today. And that means that since the 1980s, when this was first implemented for buying and selling, the mark of the beast has been in use. It's just that they're not putting it physically on anyone's bodies yet by law. Although you can pull up photos, for example, in Japan of teenagers who think that it's fashionable to get barcode tattoos on the backs of their necks or on their foreheads or that kind of thing that are visible. So here's where I'm going with that. You asked me about this thing being animated. And I mentioned voice synthesis, right? In the Europe, let's talk about the United Kingdom for a moment. In the United Kingdom, you have Queen Elizabeth II's coat of arms, her heraldic achievement on many goods that are bought and sold, printed on the packaging, right? You go to a scanner to have the barcode on an item that you're purchasing scanned when you make the purchase. We do the same thing here in the United States. Many of those scanners have voice synthesis where they can literally turn up the volume and you can hear something read out to describe what it is that you're purchasing. So you make a purchase. When you do that, let's assume for a moment that you've got the barcode on your hand or forehead instead, that it's no longer just on the packaging. And let's assume that the barcode is in an ink that those scanners can read with their lasers, but that it's not visible to the naked eye, which technologically is possible and has been possible now for several years. So let's say you've got a tattoo on your hand or forehead that the scanners can see, but I can't see it with my eyes. Okay? You stretch forth your hand or you bow your forehead to that thing for them to scan it. And then let's say they've got the volume turned up and you hear something when you make your purchase, maybe what you're purchasing or your name, your ID, whatever it is. So scripture says that this beast is going to be worshiped. And those who have the mark of the beast are going to worship him and worship it. So here's where this comes together. The technical definition in Greek for the word worship that's translated in English as worship is to bow the forehead, to stretch forth the hand, to bow the knee, to prostrate oneself before as if you were lying on the ground, or to kiss the hand, like, for example, when the Pope stretches forth his hand and somebody kisses the ring on his hand, to kiss the hand. Those are the five technical definitions of the word worship. So if you've got this mark on your hand or your forehead, and you're bowing your forehead, or you're stretching forth your hand, or let's backstep it for a moment. Let's say it's on a card, like a shopper card that you're using. Let's say it's a Costco card, like in the United States, or a Sam's Club card, or a value shopper card, you know, like for the grocery store chain where you're shopping, so that you get some discount for your purchase. Most of those cards have UPC or EAN barcodes on them. And so you've got that card in your hand, and you're stretching it forward for somebody to scan it so you can make a purchase, right? Well, you may not have in your mind that you're engaging in any form of worship whatsoever. You may have no spiritual mindedness, if you will, for the act that you're undertaking, which is a simple purchase. But by the technical definition, you are engaged in an act of worship, especially if it's associated ultimately with this Antichrist, this beast. So Prince Charles' coat of arms, his heraldic achievement, not the Queen's, but Prince Charles, has on it all the imagery of Daniel 7 and Revelation 13, as well as other symbols that are explicitly described in the Old and New Testaments for the Antichrist. And then additionally, of course, it's his title by which he's known globally, Charles, Prince of Wales, or Prince Charles of Wales, that calculates the 666. And by the way, Tony, this is in more than one language. So not only is it statistically impossible from a mathematical standpoint, statistically impossible for Charles, Prince of Wales, to calculate to 666 on the English version of the numbering system that we were talking about earlier, where the numbers are sequentially transferred to English. Although that's the reality, the title does calculate to exactly 666 in English. But as it turns out, it does so in more than one language. So in the Hebrew language, on the original numbering system where you don't actually have to transfer the numbers at all, the exact same title, the way that it's given in modern Israeli Hebrew, Charles, Prince of Wales, or Prince Charles of Wales, also calculates to exactly 666. Mathematically, that's impossible, but it's factual reality.
Well,
but here's where I'm going with this.
Have you any other specific?
I want to wrap this point up. So let's assume for a moment, in the future, your goods, it could even be here in the United States or somewhere else in the world, have Prince Charles' coat of arms on them, or let's say their register does, because now he's an authority over the nations, and I'll talk about how that will happen as well. But let's assume that his coat of arms is and widespread view at that point in history, in the not too distant future, when he's over the nations in a form of global governance. And people are now using the barcode in a more direct fashion. Let's say it's tied into their bank accounts. Maybe the number that it's encoding is an ID that ties to their bank accounts, for example, so that they can buy and sell. So they're stretching forth their hand to a register, and then they're hearing voice synthesis, right? All of that is this imagery, this beast speaking, if you will. Now, beyond that, you could have this statue that I was talking about to Prince Charles, which, by the way, is explicitly identified in the Hebrew text of Daniel 9:27, which I've not talked about. That's addressed in the second edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. So not only is it a statue and idol, but it's got a very specific design for the Hebrew root words, the Hebrew text of Daniel 9:27. So you won't get it in the English. It's another thing like going to the Greek for the number 666 in Revelation. In this case, you have to go to the Hebrew for Daniel 9:27, which talks about the statue, the abomination. But anyway, that particular statue, not just any statue, is what's actually described in the Hebrew text. And I address that in detail in the second edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea.
So look, we've got these four things so far, the 666, the heraldry, the lineage, the statue. Any more?
Yep, peace process. You know, something happened this year that was a big deal that most people have missed, including in the church, and I'll come around to that. So I documented in the first edition of the Antichrist and Cup of Tea that all of these peace process efforts around Israel actually traced directly to Prince Charles. Most people don't realize this. So in the first edition of the book published in 1998, up to that point in history, I documented that what had been heard of to that point, which was the Oslo peace process, which was set up as Oslo 1, 2, and 3, and then the peace agreement with Jordan, which sat between Oslo 1 and 2, traced back to the Madrid Peace Conference and Madrid Peace Talks in Spain shortly before that. So that's where the Oslo process came from. It derived from what was happening in Madrid, Spain, prior to that. And the Madrid Peace Talks themselves traced back to Israel's Shimon Peres, who is now deceased, and Jordan's King Hussein, at meetings that they had in London in 1987 under the auspices of a Lord Victor Mishkan, who was a lawyer doing work for the British monarchy, among others, including for Prince Charles. So at Prince Charles' behest, Lord Victor Mishkan arranged the meetings between Jordan's King Hussein, who's now deceased, his son is now King of Jordan. But Jordan's King Hussein and then Israel's Shimon Peres. Now, Shimon Peres at the time was the second, if you will, under Yitzhak Shamir, who was the premier in Israel. Shamir was not too happy about the whole thing and shelved it. Subsequently, after the Madrid peace talks, you know, which this London Agreement of 1987, and that's what it's actually called, the London Agreement of 1987, and Shimon Peres talked about that in his book called The New Middle East. That's the title of Peres's book. But anyway, after the Madrid peace talks, when Yitzhak Rabin became prime minister of Israel, and he was assassinated, you'll recall, in the mid-1990s, but Rabin allowed Peres to revive the London Agreement of 1987, and that in turn directly led to the Oslo peace talks. Now, those led to Oslo 1, 2, and 3 was supposed to happen, but never did. So Oslo 1 and 2 and 3 were divided into three agreements, two phases, if you will. Those phases were, first of all, to be security talks, and secondly, peace talks. Now, Oslo 1, and you recall there was this big signing deal on the White House lawn with Bill Clinton and, at that time, Peres and Rabin and Arafat. Oslo I was a declaration of principles that everybody signed and was actually an agreement on principles to negotiate a treaty. It was not itself a treaty. Oslo II, on the other hand, was an actual treaty. And between Oslo I and II, the peace treaty with Jordan occurred. Oslo III was supposed to be the peace treaty, which never happened. Rabin was assassinated. And in lieu of Oslo III, something called the Quartet and the Roadmap stepped into the picture, if you will. Now, up to that point, everything was directly traceable to Prince Charles. The Quartet was structured as the United States, the European Union, Russia, and then the United Nations, the UN, as the fourth member. And because the UN was in there, it was basically all the nations of the world. The Quartet was headed for a long time by Tony Blair. And you're probably familiar with that.
Well, yeah, Tony Blair was a Middle East peace envoy. I think many people in Britain raised their eyebrows when that, especially after he'd started an illegal war there.
Yes. Well, Tony Blair still reported to Prince Charles, you know, as his, you know, prince in waiting, if you will, you know, under the sovereign, he still reported to Prince Charles all that time. And now it's another British citizen who's taken over the Quartet for Tony Blair. But again, under Prince Charles. So behind the scenes, this whole effort that the whole world talks about, you know, where they get all up in arms over so-called settlements and Israel wanting to construct this or that, you know, in Eastern Jerusalem or wanting to have sovereignty over Eastern Jerusalem. And of course, you know, Israel annexed the old city of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, historically after the 1967 Six-Day War. But all that is to say, the whole thing has sat under Prince Charles all this time. And up until this year, Prince Charles and other members, until 2018, in this case, other members of the royal household of the UK, which, of course, you know, is the royal household over the nation that produced the Balfour Declaration and so forth, right? And had a big hand in dividing up the territory there in the Middle East after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, etc., to produce all those nations over there in the Middle East now, including Israel. So the British monarchy refused to officially have any member of the monarchy visit Israel, you know, after its founding in 1948. It was only William, I think it was in 2018, who made the first official visit. And then after that, Prince Charles earlier this year. And what Prince Charles did earlier this year was a very big deal. So Prince Charles had been there a couple of times previously, a few times actually, in an unofficial capacity, primarily to visit, for example, his grandmother's grave on the Mount of Olives, because she's been honored in Israel. And then William went in an official capacity in 2018, Prince Charles' son. And then this year, Prince Charles himself went for the first time. And what he did is he went for the World Holocaust Forum event as a speaker. So Israel arranged to have the Allies and the Axis powers, you know, the successors of those, speak at the WHF event this year. And so you had Germany's president speak, you had France's president speak, you had Vice President Pence for the United States speak, you had Israel's president and Prime Minister Netanyahu and Rivlin both speak, you had Russia's President Putin speak, and then instead of having the Prime Minister of the UK speak, you had Prince Charles speak. He was the other one. Of all of the speakers at the event, the two best speeches by far, and I listened to them all in full, were given by Russia's Putin, curiously enough, and Prince Charles. Prince Charles gave a stunning speech. It was fantastic. And it endeared him big time, if you will, to Israel's populace. I mean, it was a superb speech. But curiously, very curiously, Prince Charles skipped the group photos of the other world leaders. There was a photo before the speeches were given and another group photo after the speeches were given. Prince Charles was the only speaker to skip the photos in both cases. And immediately following his speech, he went to meet with Orthodox Christians, Muslims, at, in this case, an Orthodox church, and then a Muslim synagogue, and then also with Abbas for the Palestinians, specifically to push, in this case with Abbas, the division of Jerusalem and to encourage them in their effort to pursue East Jerusalem as their capital, basically stabbing Israel in the back and contravening, if you will, even what the Trump administration has been trying to do with their peace process initiative under Jared Kushner, who, by the way, and you might know this also, has a property. People have brought this up under the topic of the Antichrist, a property at an address that is 666, which is just funny in a sense. But Kushner has been the primary protagonist, along with other direct people in the Trump administration, for the I'll call it the fake or the false peace process with Israel. At any rate, Prince Charles is not in complete agreement, if you will, with what the Trump administration has pursued. He wants to see the land divided. He wants to see Jerusalem divided. He wants to see the Palestinians have their own state with half of Jerusalem, you know, as it were, the old city that has the Temple Mount area as their capital. So in a very real sense, he betrayed Israel with that, while at the same time, immediately before that, giving a superb speech against anti-Semitism and against the Holocaust and the events around it, etc. So that happened this year. And to me, that is a big red flag that we're getting close to what Christians call the tribulation period, or the tribulation week, the latter half of which, the final 3.5 years of which, is called the Great Tribulation, the period in which the Antichrist has his reign.
Okay, well, why don't you take us through this idea of Prince Charles becoming something of a figure on the world stage? Because we've got some interesting indications that that might be true. Firstly, that his association with Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum, who had a partnership agreement last September with the United Nations, which looks to me, slightly cynically maybe, is more like a hostile takeover of the United Nations, because the UN's been running out of money. The World Economic Forum, Davos in Switzerland, is awash with money. And so this partnership agreement does look as if the World Economic Forum are going to start to be calling the shots in this global regulator set up to keep the peace after World War II. So there's that side, and there's various other things as well. But particularly the other aspect of Prince Charles being somehow on the world stage, we have next April, the Queen turns 95 years old, and there are various rumours, but some announcements that she may actually retire and hand over to the next in line as a Prince Regent. Now, that could be William, it could be Charles.
Now, the World Economic Forum, they had the Great Reset, quote-unquote, that everybody's been talking about in the news, and of course, Prince Charles was a speaker there and directly referred to the quote-unquote Great Reset, which is, in a sense, just a new euphemism for the New World Order. They're talking about the same thing. And when we talk about COVID, they've talked about COVID in multiple venues and multiple contexts being something that, surprisingly to some, and I think not to others, has facilitated their Great Reset, if you will, efforts. Now, setting that aside for a moment, and I'll come back to that, the history of the United Nations itself as an organization is one of it coming out of the League of Nations. Now, the League of Nations, you know, pre-World War II, actually traces its origin not just to the victors of World War I, but to the British monarchy, and specifically the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the RIIA, or Chatham House, in London. Prince Charles heads the RIIA, or Chatham House, in London, and has for quite some time now. Additionally, so in other words, the UN traces its history to that. You would think, just on its surface, that that might give him some leverage, perhaps, in the United Nations. So to make that real, but there are multiple examples of this in even the first edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. There's more in the upcoming edition. But the United Nations has what it calls a global security lecture series, where every year now, pretty much, they've had world leaders come in and deliver lectures on global security. The very first lecture in that series ever was given by Prince Charles at the UN. Who's heard of that? And there are many initiatives like that that trace directly to Prince Charles in and outside of the United Nations, including the big push for public-private partnerships with the UN. Much of what had been called the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum in the past, PWBLF, was structured around public-private partnerships. So a lot of the things we see in the world today, where national governments partner, if you will, with industry in an almost fascist and often overtly fascist sense, traces to initiatives under the PWBLF and Prince Charles. There are many things like this that the public has not generally heard, where Prince Charles has prominence globally among globalists. When we talk about the environmental movement, for example, the modern environmental movement traces to the British monarchy. So it goes back to the Flora and Fauna Protection Society, if I remember right, of the 1800s, out of the British monarchy, which, you know, later led to things like the World Resources Institute and the World Wildlife Fund, which Prince Philip headed for quite a while, and then was headed by Prince Charles. The Rio Earth Summit of the early 1990s, I mentioned the statue to Prince Charles. The Rio Earth Summit took place prior to the publication of the first edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, so I documented that in the first edition. At that time, when it took place, most of the world had heard of Al Gore, you know, as prominent, you know, besides perhaps Prince Philip, as prominent in the global arena for environmentalism, you know, and environmental initiatives and so on. But in reality, Prince Charles was more prominent than any of them. And in fact, the key players of the Rio Earth Summit credited Prince Charles, not Al Gore. They credited Prince Charles. Al Gore also explicitly credited Prince Charles for the success of the Rio Earth Summit following the summit itself, because it was Prince Charles who organized meetings aboard the Royal Yacht Britannia of the key participants at the Rio Earth Summit, to include Al Gore, Brazil's president, a variety of other people. And because of what Prince Charles did in chairing those meetings and guiding them, those leaders subsequently credited him for the success of the summit. And that directly led to the statue that was commissioned by the state government of Tocantins in Brazil to Prince Charles. And I didn't mention this earlier, but there's an inscription on the base of that statue, Tony, and people can see this in the reporting, both the BBC audio report that was done where they filmed the statue and showed it in photos, and also the printed news articles on the statue from the early 2000s. There's an inscription at the base of that statue, and it is, quote unquote, Savior of the World, written in British spelling. S-A-V-I-O-U-R. They were calling Prince Charles specifically the Savior of the World with that statue. And I mentioned it has his face, right, and angelic wings. They were doing that in the context of viewing him as the environmental Savior of the World, okay? So the Rio Earth Summit, which the United States, sort of signed on to, sort of didn't, led to the Kyoto Protocol years later in Japan. You would have heard of that, right? That predated the Copenhagen talks in Denmark and predated the 2015 Paris climate talks or Paris Climate Conference. So I'll come back to those. But the Kyoto Protocol is something that the United States did not sign, but most of the rest of the world did. And the rest of the world was trying to get the United States on board with it for several years. And that came directly out of the rare earth talks and summit. So again, Prince Charles credited for that. Who hears about that publicly today? Almost no one. The Denmark talks, the Copenhagen talks, which took place when the Obama administration was active in the United States a few years ago, were not a success. There was not enough agreement to really lead to anything at those talks. The next round of serious talks from that took place in 2015. And these were called the Paris Climate Talks, Paris Climate Conference. It was hosted by France's president, Holland. I think that's right. But hosted by France's president. And you would think that since France's president was hosting the talks and they were taking place in Paris, that he would have been the one to open the talks and probably give the first speech and introduce everybody, etc. And if not him, then maybe somebody like Obama would have done it, right? Or Al Gore, perhaps even. That's what you would think, you know, given the level of knowledge the public has and the things that the public media puts out there. That would be the normal guess of a person on the street, I would think. But in actuality, it was Prince Charles. Prince Charles personally opened the event. He gave the first speech at the event. And then at the group photo for the event, he was at the very center of all the world leaders in the position of prominence over everybody else globally. At that event, you had the largest gathering of global leadership in the history of the entire world in one place at one time. 150 plus world leaders, in other words, heads of nations. 190 plus world leaders overall, but 150 plus heads of state. And none of them opened the event. Prince Charles opened the event. He's not even the head of state, right? Why? We have to ask the question, why? And it's because all of those people, global leadership, they know behind the scenes just how prominent Prince Charles actually is. They know that this whole global thing, all this global talk of anthropogenic, you know, human-caused global warming kind of thing, this whole thing is sitting beneath Prince Charles. And at that conference, Prince Charles stated that they needed to transfer roughly $9 trillion with a T, not billion, but trillion dollars in taxes from the world's nations to finance dealing with global warming in the near future. Now, when you think about this, and I break this down, by the way, in the second edition of the Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, $9 trillion is enough money to put every human being whom they claim is in danger at any point in the future of being affected by so-called global warming and rising seas and this kind of thing in very nice homes, brand new, very nice homes everywhere on the planet. That's how much $9 trillion is. It's like it's almost $200,000 per person, roughly. You know, of those they're claiming to be potentially threatened or affected by global warming in the future. So it's an enormous sum of money. But what it really is a scam to enable a form of taxation through global warming, if you will, to facilitate global governance in the future. And it's all under Prince Charles. So, you know, that's an example of his prominence, you know, apart from what happened in Israel earlier this year. In this case, that's related to the climate stuff. But there are many other examples. And so I address this in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. And these are things that people would look at and say, gee, that's true. Why didn't I hear about that? Or why hasn't anybody put that together as a list of things that he's been front and center for? You know, so for example, in the first edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, is that, you know, there are lots of other examples. You'll recall that the UK turned over Hong Kong to communist China in the 1990s, right? Still there?
Yes, yes. Okay. Yes, that definitely did happen.
Yeah. Yeah. So who did that? Who did that for the United Kingdom?
Well, what they say here is a chap called Chris Patton, who then went on to become chairman of the BBC.
No, Prince Charles. Prince Charles personally handed over Hong Kong. And in fact, they filmed him doing it. So it was Prince Charles for the UK who did that. And when you go back to world events, his investiture in July of 1969 was the most widely viewed event in the history of the world at the time, an estimated television audience of 500 million plus. The only event to that point in history to rival it was the Apollo 11 moon landing in the same month. Then after that, his wedding to Princess Diana, estimated television audience of 1 billion plus, up to 1.5 billion, 1.75 billion people, depending on what estimate you read, somewhere between 1.25 billion, 1.75 billion estimate. Then, you know, of television audience. Then after that, his handover of Hong Kong to communist China, the new most widely viewed event in the history of the world up to that point. And then after that, we get into other things like what I've been talking about so far in the interview. So how do you explain that about one human being who has the imagery, the name calculation, the lineage, the statue? And again, not just any statue. You know, I mentioned the Hebrew root words in Daniel 9:27. I show in the second edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea that the statue is associated with somebody whose name means strong man. You know, it has to do with the idea of imposition or enforcement for the treaty that's addressed in the same verse of Daniel chapter 9. This treaty, in other words, this false peace treaty that the Antichrist is involved with, and Israel is involved with, this whole thing around the false peace process that relates to this statue. And all of that is in this one verse in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. The Hebrew root words describing that statue talk about it having overspreading wings, dressed only in a loincloth, if you can believe that. It's bizarre. But the root words actually indicate that the statue is dressed in a loincloth. And it's associated with someone whose name means strong man in the Hebrew text. And it's associated with someone who is a prince, and not just any prince. There are multiple words for prince in Hebrew. This particular word for prince means heir apparent to a throne. So in other words, it's a prince who's in line to be on a throne, who's not actually on a throne, and who's not in line to be on a throne, but who is in line to be on a throne. So the name Charles in English means strong man. That's what it actually means. Not everybody knows that, but that's the meaning of the word Charles.
What does this actually mean when it comes to interpreting the events of Revelation? I think maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, but it would be certainly interesting to hear what you think, you know, whoever the Antichrist turns out to be, how that is likely to look. You already talked about 3.5 years, but can you tell us, you know, in just like 5 minutes or something? I know it's a short time, but how you think Revelation is speaking to us today about, it's a bit like a crystal ball telling us what's going to happen. And of course, you know, with a loving God would do that. You know, they wouldn't just leave his people to be confused, upset, that he would make sure that the purpose was shown to them. What do you think is going to unfold as these events in Revelation take place here on earth?
Okay, so in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, the first edition, pages 394 to 96, I actually gave a list of events that would precede the start of the Great Tribulation. And it's at the Great Tribulation that the Antichrist actually comes to power. So the Great Tribulation is that 3.5-year period in which he has his global authority. There are a series of events scripturally that are to precede that. The Great Tribulation itself begins roughly in the fourth year of a 7-year period that Christians call the tribulation period or the tribulation week. It's a period outlined also in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. It's a 7-year period. Now, Revelation is structured around 7 seals. It's roughly a seal per year. The fourth seal is where we get into the fourth horseman, and there are 3 horsemen, or horsemen per seal for the first 3 seals, where the first one is a white horse, then the second one is a fiery red horse, the third one is it's not really black, it's translated as black, but it's not really an accurate translation. It's more like a dark blue, black, grayish, red-hued kind of a horse, which is very strange sounding, but it's actually the coloration of that horse that's called Blucifer outside of Denver International Airport. People can look that up, BLU, just like Lucifer, but with B in front of it, Blucifer. That horse with the fiery red eyes, when it's lit up at night, it's that coloration. And then the fourth horseman, which is typically translated as gray or ashen, is actually it's pale green-gray is what the Greek text means, and it's actually the color of rotting flesh. And as it turns out, the unicorn on Prince Charles' coat of arms has that exact coloration, and when you scan it on a color scanner, and you look at it digitized, for example, on a display, not printed, because CMYK, when you print it like on the cover of a book, can't actually reproduce all those colors. But on a display, like an RGB display, you can see them. And on an RGB display, you can see that unicorn has a greenish hue to it. So it's not just gray. It's pale green gray. So the point is, all the horses have specific functions that lead up to the Great Tribulation, specific prophetic events that occur. The second horseman is this fiery red horse. Now, my book, North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War, Behold a Red Horse, I'm showing that the fiery red horse and its rider and the sword spoken of in the second seal, which summarizes the second year roughly of that 7-year period. So sometime before the Great Tribulation begins, sometime before World War III, sometime before the global government is constituted, that the events under that second seal pertain to North Korea, Iran, the oil industry, specifically Mobil Oil and ExxonMobil, which is an interesting tie-in with Rex Tillerson, who had been the Secretary of State under Trump for a while, and then Saudi Arabia and Iran generally, where they use the sword as a symbol for Islam. You know, Iran has the sword on its flag. The fiery red horse is actually the national symbol of North Korea, kind of like the United States, for example, has the eagle on the dollar bill. I show in this book, North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War, that is the national symbol of North Korea. They have it on their currency. It overlooks downtown Pyongyang. The United States had the Red Horse Brigades, which is an acronym. It was an engineering set of brigades facing off against North Korea in the Korean War, called the Red Horse Brigades because that's the national symbol of North Korea, etc. So the other horsemen, I believe I've identified. Some of that information is in the second edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, the rest in my other upcoming books. But all this is to say there are a series of events to take place. What I address specifically in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea is that we will see Israel attacked. And also, by the way, I address this in Israel, quote unquote, peace in the coming world war, that multi-volume series that's coming out. But we'll see Israel attacked successfully, where Jerusalem is encircled by Israel's enemies. And half of the city, only half, meaning the half that Israel captured in the 67 war, will be taken by force from Israel, and that will include the Temple Mount area. And when that transpires, at the same time that that is transpiring, the abomination that causes desolation will be erected, and that means that by that point in history, some portion of a new temple will have to have been constructed and be sitting on the Temple Mount so that the statue can be put there, the large full-size version of it. So the statue will be erected, and then also the Antichrist will receive a mortal wound so that he recovers from it in a way that the world literally begins to worship him, and he'll be possessed by Satan at that point, just as Judas Iscariot was possessed by the devil before he went to betray Christ so that he'd be crucified. In this case, the Antichrist will be possessed right before he goes to betray Israel as a nation, if you will, with half of Jerusalem taken captive in war.
So well, betraying that whole peace process. I hesitate to interrupt you, Tim, but this idea of constructing a temple in Jerusalem, does rather rankle with the Muslims, because it is feasible that the ancient Al-Aqsa Mosque may have to be demolished in order to construct that temple. Now, that would seem to be a potential powder keg for a war anyway.
Well, that's true. And there is a long-running debate, decades long, in Israel and among archaeologists as to whether or not that mosque is actually sitting where the temple was or sitting adjacent to where the temple was. And I've done my own research on this. I tend to agree with those who say that the Wailing Wall, or Western Wall, was an outer wall of the temple compound historically. In other words, that where Israel thinks the temple sat is correct, that they've correctly identified the actual location. So it may be that it requires some sort of an agreement between Israel and her adversaries to construct something next to or adjacent to the mosque. It's quite clear that Israel's government to this point has been very cowardly and fearful of rankling the surrounding Muslim nations, you know, which number, you know, hundreds of millions of people. If you add up, you know, if you include Indonesia, it's a ton of people. But even just the surrounding nations, several tens of millions of people versus Israel's very small Jewish populace. So, yes, Israel has nuclear weapons, perhaps. They don't admit
they
to
do.
It. But
yes, they do.
And could do a lot of damage. But what can you do when they keep coming like ants, right, if you rile them enough? So in this case, Israel's been very fearful to construct anything, even for that matter, to allow open worship or prayers of, you know, Jewish or Christian people in the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And so it's very likely that it will require either a new Israeli government that is very so-called right-wing, and just says, you know, to whatever, you know, with the surrounding Muslim nations, we're going to trust God to defend us if they attack us. And by the way, they won't want to be turned into, you know, radioactive whatever if they do. You know, some right-wing government to just throw caution to the wind and proceed with plans that have been underway now for decades to be able to construct a new temple compound, probably adjacent to the mosque, but, you know, there could be an earthquake that wipes out the mosque. Any number of things could happen. It could be wiped out in some intervening war. We just don't know. Or they could get some political agreement to construct something on the basis of the whole, you know, false peace process, if there is some other agreement to be made.
I mean, surely there is another way, and that is that there is some kind of sensible understanding between Christians, Jews, and Muslims. Same building, could the same building not be used on Fridays as a mosque, on Saturdays as a synagogue, and on Sundays as a church?
Well, I would say it's the Orthodox, and to a lesser extent the ultra-Orthodox, but primarily the Orthodox in Israel who wish to build a temple, who actually care about a temple much more so than the ultra-Orthodox, many of whom would agree with Iranian leaders, you know, that Zionism shouldn't exist, that Israel as a nation shouldn't be there in the land today because the Messiah hasn't come yet, this kind of thing. Much more so than, in other words, Reform, conservative, or even ultra-Orthodox, so, or for that matter, secular Jews who really don't care. They just want to live in peace. So for that reason, I would say, given that it is the Orthodox community that has the biggest stake in the construction of the new temple, it's unlikely to me that they would agree to what they would clearly view as apostasy, to a compromise to worship in a mosque under any circumstance. The rest of Israel probably would agree to it. So we'll have to see how that works out. That being said, you know, there are many Christians also who think that Israel will sign some sort of a treaty under the auspices of the Antichrist, this prince of Roman lineage per Daniel 9:27, this treaty that's to be imposed or enforced. I submit that the scripture does not require Israel to sign anything. It also does not require Israel's enemies, specifically in this case, the so-called Palestinians who are claiming East Jerusalem, etc., to sign.
Well, hang on, Tibbs. It's not just them, is it? This is the UN as well. I mean, historically, this the territory has been pinched by the Israelis at like the Golan Heights. Much of it is actually not officially theirs. They've just stolen it. And the idea really is to say, oh, we need a buffer zone against the Arabs. But then you have another buffer zone, and every one of those buffer zones contains human beings who are living, who are then being occupied by a foreign power.
Well, I'd say whenever we use the word steal, we have to talk about historical context. And when we talk about historical context, we also have to talk about time period. So if we talk time periods, ancient Israel, meaning the time period of David and Solomon and before them, after the exodus from Egypt, had that territory. Before there was an entity called the Palestinians, before Islam existed as a religion, before Christianity existed, etc., Israel had the territory. God had given it to Israel. And God had delineated in the Old Testament certain borders for the land that he had promised to give to Israel, conditioned on Israel being faithful to him.
But it creates a very dangerous precedent, surely, because you've now got Palestinians saying, actually, we want our land back, the land that the Israeli settlers have illegally taken from us.
Well, sure, I'll come to that. So, you know, historically, there was never a time in history, ever, when Israel had all of the land that God promised to Israel. And that land would be bordered by the Nile River, by the Euphrates River, and then by the seas. So if you were to take that chunk of land today, it would be huge. There'd be no Saudi Arabia, no Qatar, no Oman, no UAE, no Lebanon, no Jordan. A quarter of Egypt would be gone. A big chunk of Iraq would be gone. And some other smaller nations would all be, Kuwait would be gone. Some other smaller nations would all be part of that territory that would then be called Israel in the biblically defined promised land. So there's that. But then historically, Israel was never faithful to God. Israel was constantly unfaithful to one degree or another. The only time in history when Israel had a significant chunk of that territory was under David and Solomon. And Solomon, in half of his reign, was a type of Christ. He was faithful to God in half of his reign. In the other half of his reign, he became a type of the Antichrist, even up to the number 666 being associated with him. And he became very unfaithful to God and participating in the worship of all the false gods of the nations, the surrounding nations.
And he built a temple.
But anyway, all of that, and that was when he was being faithful to God, mostly that he did that initially. But the point is, Israel ultimately was so unfaithful to God that Israel participated in the Roman crucifixion of Christ, you know, demanding the crucifixion, unbelieving Israel, right? So after that, around that time of Christ's coming, and then after that on into the early first century, roughly one-third, one in three Israelites, believed that Yeshua was the Messiah and the God of Israel incarnate. The other two-thirds rejected that. And the rejecting portion became so rebellious toward the Roman Empire, which God had allowed still to control the territory of the nation up to that point, the portion of the territory that Israel actually controlled, which was called Judea, became so rebellious that Rome had just had enough, came in and you know, sacked the temple roughly AD 70 under Titus and the Roman legions, and Israel's surrounding enemies enlisted into the Roman armies that participated in that destruction. Terrible destruction, terrible death in Israel, mass murder of Israelites. But again, practically all of them were non-believers because Christ had warned believing Israelites to flee from Judea and Jerusalem to the mountains in the wilderness when they would see Jerusalem encircled. Now, his warnings had to do with what for us are still future events. But back there in the second century, they said, now, wait a minute, this seems to apply now. And they got out of Dodge, so to speak, in this case, out of Jerusalem, out of Judea. And so many of those whom the Romans killed were not believers. They were unbelieving Israelites. And then the rest got scattered in the early second century under the Bar Kokhba revolution. Bar Kokhba was set up as a false messiah, an antichrist figure by unbelieving Israel. Got scattered to the rest of the nations and throughout the Roman Empire, and ultimately scattered around the world. And so Israel ended, and as a nation, as a national entity with a geographic territory. And the Romans renamed the land Palestine. That's where the name came from originally. They said there's not going to be an Israel anymore. Now it's Palestine. And so when you get to the 4th century AD, and the Roman Catholic Church is constituted under Constantine, and they took all these pagans throughout the Roman Empire, and now they said, okay, now you're Christians. You can keep your idols. We'll call this one Mary, and you can call Semiramis and Isis Mary, and you know Horus and Tammuz, you can call them baby Jesus, and you can keep your idols to the woman and her child. Just we'll rename them what the Zodiac intended them to originally be, and we'll call, you know, the winter solstice, the winter celebration, Christmas, and yada, yada. So they Christianized all this stuff. They turned the feast of Astarte, or to the goddess Astarte, or Isis, or whatever, into Easter.
Cut to the chase, and finally, so, to link
so
up,
today,
if you can, Prince Charles, right, with right, what's going to be happening you know, in the end times, finally. I mean, where is it all going to end up, and who's going to win or lose?
Okay, you have two children in the Promised Land now. You recall two children were brought before Solomon, right? Or one child, I should say, two mothers. They each had a child. One mother rolled over on her child in the night. He suffocated. He died. She stole the other woman's child, claimed it for her own. They ended up going before Solomon, who offered to cut the child in two, right? And give half to each of the two women. Now, the woman whose child it wasn't was pleased with the arrangement. She said, okay. The other woman was, you know, beside herself over it and said, no, you know, give the child to this woman who's stolen from me. I'm paraphrasing, okay? So the real mother didn't want to see her child cut in two. The false mother was pleased to see it happen in order to spite the real mother, because her child had lived. All right? That's the situation today. The so-called Palestinians are basically Arabs from surrounding territories who initially under the Ottoman Empire, but more so in the early 19th century and later, and some of them late in the 20th century, and then some of them late in the 19th century, you know, moved in to those lands, cultivated fields, etc., and then around the time of the Balfour Declaration and afterwards became called this Palestinian entity, which they weren't before. Jordan was supposed to have been, you know, around the time of the Balfour Declaration and afterwards, Jordan was supposed to have been the so-called Palestinian
state. But don't
state.
The Israeli state have to show a good example of a good moral behavior in order to actually claim that land?
No. What Israel does have to do is turn back to God faithfully. And until Israel does turn back to her God, and by that I mean become Christian, en masse, overnight, until that occurs, the nation will continue to be attacked by her surrounding enemies, and it will become so severe. In other words, God will turn Israel over to her enemies, just as he did historically, when we had the Assyrian captivity and then the Babylonian captivity and then what Rome did, to the point where half of Jerusalem is taken captive in war. Those who are taken captive are carried away as far as Babylon and Iraq. And, you know, Saddam Hussein had been rebuilding the capital of Babylon and Iraq.
So, yeah, but do you see the Israelis doing that? And obviously, you know, if you're going to change over to being a Christian nation, then it's going to also mean a change of heart. It's going to mean a change of morality.
It won't happen until the majority of Israel sees Christ return in person at his second advent. So what will happen is with this captivity, those who remain in Judea, and God has commanded Christians, believers in other words, specifically, and I'm talking Jew and Gentile alike. So Jew would be somebody like me, you know, a Levite who happens to believe that Yeshua, Jesus, is the Messiah and the God of Israel incarnate, just like every Christian there is. So someone like me, and then Gentiles, non-Israelite Christians. He's commanded those who believe to get out of Judea, which is, by the way, where most of modern Israel's population is. In the modern nation of Israel, the vast majority of the Israelite population from all of the tribes who are there are residing in the territory that historically was called Judea, including Jerusalem. And so Christ has commanded in the Olivet Discourses those who do serve him, who believe in him, to leave Jerusalem, to leave Judea, to flee to the mountains in the wilderness, to get out of Dodge, if you will, when we see A, the abomination that causes desolation erected in this holy place where it's not supposed to be, and B, Jerusalem surrounded by the militaries of the nations. And Christ justified his command to his disciples by saying, "For there will be great tribulation upon this people." When he says this people, he's talking about those who are in Judea, geographically speaking. So it's geographically constrained to those who are in the area of Judea, which is where modern Israel is for the most part. So great tribulation is going to come upon them. And according to Ezekiel chapters 5 and 6 and Zechariah chapters 12 through 14, and I address this in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, and also in my upcoming Messiah History and the Tribulation Period multi-volume series, according to those prophecies, two-thirds of Israel who remain there in the land in Judea are going to die. So we're talking about, Tony, the equivalent of a new Holocaust, literally, where millions of Israelites are going to die in a short period of time, within a period of under 3.5 years. And that is only years from now that is going to begin. And it'll be under the period in which the Antichrist has his global rule. Now, out of that period and during that period, you will have a couple of things. One will be two witnesses, two prophets of God, who will prophesy to the nation of Israel and will be in Israel during that time. The two people who are protected supernaturally by God from the plagues that are occurring and the judgments that are occurring. One of them will be the actual Elijah of the Old Testament sent back to earth, in other words, brought from the past to the future by God to testify to Israel, the actual prophet Elijah. So not like John, who was a type of Elijah in the crucifixion week and in Christ's first advent, the actual Elijah of history, in other words. The other prophet, we don't know who that is, if it's going to be somebody who was born in our generation, if it's going to be Moses, or if it's going to be Enoch, a pre-flood prophet, pre-Noah's flood prophet, who, like Elijah, was taken by God directly to heaven, who never died. We don't know who it is. But those two witnesses are going to testify to Israel, and they're simultaneously going to torture the nations of the world that are afflicting Israel during that 3.5 year period in which two-thirds of those who are in Judea die. And then with that, additionally, you'll have at some point, not immediately, but at some point, 144,000 sealed Israelites. The tribe of Dan is completely excluded from among them. So the tribe of Joseph gets 24,000. Of the 144,000, 12,000 from Manasseh, 12,000 from Ephraim, the two half-tribes of Joseph, comprising that 144,000 who will be witnesses to the nation of Israel, unbelieving Israel, during that period, telling Israel that Jesus, Yeshua, really is the Messiah of Israel, really is the God of Israel, and that he's coming back to save the nation. As soon as the nation cries out to him and acknowledges him for who he is, the God of Israel incarnate. So at the end of that 3.5-year period, right before the nations gather for the Battle of Armageddon, and as Christ returns looking like a bright burning star toward the earth, the surviving third of Israel up to that point, the remainder of Israel, will en masse recognize that they'll finally recognize that the two witnesses have been telling them the truth. The church all this time has been telling them the truth, and their own rabbis have been lying through their teeth all these centuries. When they say that Jesus, Yeshua, isn't the Messiah or the God of Israel, they've been completely misled by their religious leadership. They will finally realize that Jesus, Yeshua, really is the God and Messiah of Israel. And as soon as that happens, he will begin to defend the nation of Israel. And when the nations gather for the Battle of Armageddon under the Antichrist to try to prevent what then is about to occur, meaning where the God of Israel is going to go forward and annihilate Israel's enemies globally, totally wipe them out, including all their militaries.
Okay, so you seem to be hinting that maybe Prince Charles is heading for a global role rather than taking over as king here in England. He may be passing it on to William.
Well, it's his title. And I wrote this, by the way, in the first edition of the Antichrist and Captivity. So this is not new. I have maintained all this time that he will not be king of England. I have maintained even in the first edition of the book published in 1998 that he might become king of Europe instead. And it was after his investiture in July of 1969 that he publicly made known, publicly, that he wanted to be king of Europe, not king of England. He stated that publicly. And so I've maintained that he could become, potentially, king of Europe, because genealogically the British monarchy is the royal house, not only of England and then Germany, because, you know, they had been Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. So not only of England and Germany, you know, having renamed it to House of Windsor, but also France and Greece, etc. So they are the monarchy, if you will, of Europe today. If the European Union wanted to choose, if that ever happened, its own monarchy, there's no question that it would be the British monarchy. But regardless, I've maintained that Prince Charles will remain either Prince of Wales, because it's his title, Charles, Prince of Wales, that calculates the 666 on that biblical numbering system, through the point where he attains his global role. In other words, gains control over that future global government, or that if he becomes King of England, he'll achieve or acquire some new title that likewise calculates to 666. But there's another component
interesting
to this.
Waiting till next April to find out if you're right. Can you just finally just tell us whereabouts people can get hold of your various books?
Sure, thank you. Prophecyhouse.com, P-R-O-P-H-E-C-Y. So, you know, E-C-Y, Echo, Charlie, yes, Prophecyhouse, H-O-U-S-E.com.
And what about on other platforms like Amazon, etc.?
Well, Amazon has the North Korea book. Not so long ago, I haven't talked about it or done a lot of interviews on it, so it hasn't had a lot of sales yet. But it's North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War. The second edition of the Antichrist and Cup of Tea will probably be available there in print. The biggest issue I've had with Amazon's platform is they've allowed false reviews, and they refuse to remove them. So if you were to look at North Korea and Iran, that book, it's got two reviews, one five-star and one one-star, and the one-star review is completely fake. Can't get Amazon to remove it so far. So ultimately, I'd like to make it all available through Amazon as well. That will depend on Amazon being more honorable than it's been to this point when I approach them after these other books are out, you know, as they come out.
Tim, you've got to allow a reviewer to criticize as well as, you know, praise you.
Oh, I don't mind criticism. I'm talking about outright fake reviews. In other words, where they didn't actually read the book, they're not saying anything that's true about the book. So, for example, there's a fake review on the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea posted recently, even after it's been out of print, where they're saying that I, as an author in the book, am praising Islam throughout the book. That's literally what they say. Anyone who reads the book or anything that I've ever posted publicly online knows that's not true. It's the exact opposite of the truth.
Okay, so it's prophecyhouse.com.
Yeah, prophecyhouse.com. And then the North Korea book, the person who wrote a one-line review, if you look at all reviews, and unfortunately Amazon doesn't show comments on reviews automatically anymore, you have to actually click to view all reviews, quote unquote, before you can see the comments that have been posted against individual reviews. So in that one-star review on the North Korea book, there are a couple of people, one of them is Prophecy House, but then some other person, I don't know, who commented on the fact that that was obviously a fake review. So, but you can see that. It's just a matter of people being able to rely on the stars that they're seeing.
Yeah,
so in this case, I'll just say people need to go read the reviews.
I've just remembered, very quickly, Tim, can you just give us your take on COVID in literally 2 minutes?
Yes. Okay. So this is a bit of a segue, and just bear with me for a moment, but I will be under your two-minute limit. Some of the material in the upcoming Solar Apocalypse series, which is the one that deals with non-terrestrial life. I deal a lot with science fiction, specifically movies and books and so forth, particularly books and movies and TV shows, dealing with aliens and this kind of thing. And for that, one of the things that I watched was a movie called Shrieker Island, the most recent Tremors movie. I noticed in the text, the script for that movie, some lines that were out of place, where they talked about a viral pandemic, an airborne viral pandemic. They talked about, quote unquote, the Pennsylvania Steel, and some other lines that directly relate to the election that just occurred in the United States. The movie was filmed more than a year ago. So in other words, the manuscript for the movie was completed more than a year ago. It was filmed more than a year ago. And it was recently released before the election occurred in the United States. But the lines in it, the text, explicitly indicate, and they're out of place for the movie entirely, that there was a plan to have an airborne pandemic and then a quote-unquote Pennsylvania Steel. And Nevada is mentioned and some other things that suggest, bizarrely, that there was some plot to use a pandemic virus like COVID as part of enabling this election fraud that has occurred. Now, this is totally different from all the stuff that we hear in the news. But if people were to go to my Parler account, Parlay, at author Tim Cohen, I actually posted those quotes from that movie where they can see what I'm talking about in the exact time segments in that recent movie. That's just bizarre. So all that is to say that and other things suggest to me that the Democrats have used this as another coup attempt to remove President Trump, who opposes a lot of the New World Order agenda. He's kind of an impediment to it. And then the Great Reset thing under Prince Charles and so forth, really with the WEF, World Economic Forum, et cetera, is all part of that as well.
Okay, but do you think people need to be really concerned about COVID-19 and the vaccine?
I think there's no question that the virus is very dangerous, that it's real. I'm not suggesting otherwise. It is a real pandemic. I don't think that everything that's been said about it publicly is true. I do think that some of the vaccines potentially could be very dangerous. We really don't know, particularly the messenger RNA-based vaccines, which are a new technology where they're inserting something into your cells to cause them to produce antibodies. The danger with those vaccines, the mRNA vaccines like the Pfizer and the other one, drawing a blank on the name of the company at the moment. But anyway, the danger is that the messenger RNA they're using is encapsulated in a nanoparticle that's comprised of chemicals that produce an allergic reaction in the body. And what we don't know is how quickly the body purges itself of those chemicals, or even if it does do so. The messenger RNA breaks down very quickly in the body, but we don't know about the chemicals. And secondly, whether people immediately or down the road will have severe anaphylactic type allergic reactions to those nanoparticles themselves. And we don't know the long-term effect of those kinds of vaccines, whether they'll cause some sort of massive genetic damage, up to and including, for example, sterilization, if you wanted to get really into conspiratorial type things. So there hasn't been enough time for them to be proven in terms of their safety.
Okay, Tim Cohen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tony.